Well, hello, hello. What's up, friends, peoples, everybody? Glad you're here. Hit subscribe, follow us on social. Y'all know the thing, man. Let's get into this deal. Yeah, we're here. I'm in quick today. I'm ready to get to work. I'm ready to talk about some music. Got Aslan Freeman on the show. Awesome dude, great friend. Got connected with him through a mutual friend, and we got to hang out and talk a little bit. And man, just a great guy. He is out there killing it on the road as a music director for Lainey Wilson, who country superstar. If you don't know about Lainey Wilson, I don't know where you've been hiding, but she's blown up this year. Awesome person too. Great record, Bell Bottom Country, out this year, winning every award imaginable, and you're just killing it. And had a great conversation with Aslan. We're going to get into that as well. But it got me thinking about music directors. If you don't know what a music director, MD, does, they do a lot. They usually are the guys on the tour or girls on the tour, putting together the band, responsible for that sort of thing, making sure the band's tight, making sure they know the tunes, making sure they got the equipment that they need. You know, they're directing the music. See, makes sense. And then live on stage, they're usually talking to the band, you know, redoing arrangements, whatever. If they got to do a special, you know, acoustic thing or whatever, they're doing arrangements. They're doing all that kind of stuff. And so they have a big job. They usually stick around with artists for a while. And they're kind of unsung heroes in the industry. Like, music directors are hardworking people. They have to know everybody's parts in the band. They have to understand what's going on. They have to understand the artist's vision, make sure that the band, the back line, the players are doing what they should do, making sure they hire the right people, you know, all that sort of stuff. And so it's a huge job. Got me thinking about music directors that I really just love and respect. Aslan's obviously one of those. What he's done with Lainey's band is just phenomenal. Her band is amazing. Tommy, Kevin, and Matt, and all those guys are awesome. I briefly got to meet each one of those guys, but super kind, great players, super humble. Just, man, her whole atmosphere around her whole band and team, Lainey's deal, is just amazing. And so, but I wanted to talk a little bit about music directors since I've got Aslan on the show today. First, I want to talk a little bit about Adam Blackstone. A lot of people know the name Adam Blackstone. He released a record earlier this year, or late in 2022. I can't remember. I would say it's like a R&B pop gospel kind of record. I don't know. He's got all kinds of features on it because the dude's been an MD for like everybody under the sun. He was the music director for Rihanna at the Super Bowl this past year, but he's been MD for Kanye, J. Cole, Timberlake, Janet Jackson. I mean, Adam Blackstone's been in the industry a long time. He's like the MD's MD. Great dude. Unbelievable. Just want to shout out to these guys. Also, David Cook, one of my favorites. David Cook is a jazz pianist. I was just in New York about a month or so ago and had my family there. We were on kind of spring break vacation, and I just missed David Cook playing in a little club there by a few days, and I would have loved to have gone. David's an incredible music director. He's the music director for Taylor Swift's Eras Tour right now, which is the biggest tour in the history of the history of tours. It seems like she's like selling out three nights in a row in stadiums in every town. I've heard it's just been amazing. David he's not only been Taylor Swift's MD, but like Mary Morris and Kesha. He's been a music director for a lot of people. He's an incredible jazz pianist, and the stuff that he does like musically is awesome. Just like Adam Blackstone, as well. Another favorite music director of mine, Peter Stroud, one of my favorite guitar players as well. Peter Stroud, he's a Atlanta guy. He's played in a lot of different bands, but he's been a music director for Sheryl Crow for, I've got to be over 20, 25 years. He's been Sheryl Crow's music director. He's a great player, super nice, super humble guy. Gotten to hang out with him a couple of times, and it's been a while, but man, he's just an awesome guy, an incredible player, just oozes mojo. And he's a constant. I mean, their band's amazing. Sheryl Crow's band is amazing. And it's been pretty consistent for most of her career. But Peter's just an incredible player. Incredible guy. What they've done with Sheryl Crow's band over the years has been amazing. But I have a lot of admiration for Pete as a player too. And lastly, I want to mention Pauly Lovejoy. Pauly's a Jamaican guy, percussionist. But an incredible music director, producer, super creative, really different kind of guy. He's been an MD for the Gorillaz. He's currently an MD for Harry Styles. Just did that last tour where Harry was in like different cities for like 8 or 9 days at a time, doing arena stuff. And just a really interesting, unique, doing something fresh as a producer and as an MD, Pauly Lovejoy, check him out. If you understand the job, or maybe you don't know how that works, maybe you're listening to the podcast and you're a musician and you're like, yeah, dude, I get it. MDs, I know what a music director is. Then you know how hard that job is. Maybe you've never heard that the artist has these people who work alongside of them and help translate things for the band, work with the band and all that sort of stuff. And it's a hard job. So if you see somebody on stage who looks like the captain of the ship, who's kind of communicating with the musicians and all that sort of stuff, then no, they got a tough job, and they're usually incredibly, or mostly always, incredibly talented people who understand what it's like to put a team together. And that's a really hard job. So shout out to all the MDs out there. And shout out to my friend Aslan Freeman. I'm going to get into that in just a second. Before I do, record of the episode. Usually I have a record of the episode that has something to do with like the guest and, you know, what I'm talking about here in the intro of the show. It has nothing to do with that today. I just found it this week. Went to a new record shop close to my house with my friend Mike, and got a copy of Young MC Stone Cold Rhymin'. If you don't know nothing about Young MC, now, let me talk about it. 1989, Bust a Move. You know Bust a Move. Principal's Office. I bought this on a cassette tape at a Walmart in Vivian, Louisiana when I was, I don't know, 10. I don't know. I mean, I was 10 when the record came out, so 10 or 11. But Quincy Jones produced a bunch of this record. I mean, it's stellar. Flea from the Chili Peppers played bass on Bust a Move, which you everybody knows Bust a Move, dude. It's like it's one of those like cultural anthems. It's like all over the world. It's been played at, you know, every prom ever and every sporting event, I feel like, you know, all that sort of stuff. I don't know what's going on with Young MC right now, but this record in particular was fantastic. That cassette tape, I wore that thing out. There's some killer songs on here. This was kind of a new era of hip hop. I think Young MC, Biz Markie, the Fat Boys, there was like some buzz around this era of hip hop that was just really fun and really just, it was everywhere. Culturally, it was everywhere. And so I think this record's more important than it gets love for. If you're watching on YouTube or Spotify video, I'm holding up the vinyl right now. You can get a copy on vinyl for $25 somewhere. I think that's what I paid for this. I just never seen it before. And then I like went online. I was like, is this hard to find? And you can get it. Like, it's been repressed. A great repressing. Sounds great. But anyway, it's a great record. If you've never listened to Stone Cold Rhymin', Young MC, check it out. Great record. Today on the show, my friend Aslan Freeman, like I said, he's a fantastic guitar player and music director for country superstar Lainey Wilson. Aslan's also a producer, multi-instrumentalist. Like most music directors, he just gets how it all goes together. I had an opportunity a couple weeks ago, about a month ago, to hang out with him and the rest of Lainey's band at their sold-out show at the Roxy. They also sold out the Tabernacle that weekend. Lainey's just the real deal. And her band's the same. Aslan's the same. It was a great show. Took my whole family. Everybody had a great time. My son, my daughter, my wife, a friend of my daughter's. Like, it was just a great, great atmosphere and show. And we had a great conversation, Aslan and I do in this episode, about he's from North Carolina originally, and we had a great conversation about just growing up there and some of the records and artists that he was into and all that sort of stuff and what they got going on the road with Lainey right now. And I think you're going to love this conversation that I had with my friend Aslan Freeman. Aslan Freeman, how are you, dude?
Good, man. How are you?
I'm good. It's good to see you.
Yeah, good to be seen. Good to see you.
It's been a minute, dude. Yeah, it was great hanging out with you guys with a couple. Was it just? I guess just a month ago.
Yeah, I was good. Don't ask me how long ago it was.
I can't imagine. No, I can't imagine. I know you're home for like a day, and then you're gone, and then you're home for a couple of days. But like, how many shows are you guys going to do with Lainey this year? Do you know?
The last number I heard was like 140.
Oh, okay, that is crazy.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's somehow like, I don't know. It sounds like we could do more for some reason in my head, but I know that's ridiculous because I know what 140 shows feels like.
Yeah. I mean, y'all did close to that last year, huh?
Yeah. We were really close to that last year, I think. I think it was 125 or something.
That is nuts, dude. I can't imagine. And yeah. but you're home for a minute.
Yeah.
Yeah. you home's Nashville. Where are you from originally?
I grew up in North Carolina. This town called Sanford, which is basically like, if you look at the map, it is the exact center of the state.
Oh, wow.
So like not a big town, not a lot there, but you were like 45 minutes to downtown Raleigh, 40 minutes to Fayetteville, 30 to Southern Pines, 35 to Chapel Hill. Like you get anywhere pretty quickly. So even though they're, yeah, I remember when we got, you know, like a real movie theater in an Applebee's in high school, and that was a really big deal. You know?
Applebee's, dude.
Yeah. So at least we didn't have to drive to Cary to go to Applebee's anymore. You know.
I remember the same thing, but it was with Whataburger where I was from. We got
We just got Whataburger here in Nashville, and everybody's psyched, you know?
Like, yeah, we just got one here in Georgia. There's never been a Whataburger in Georgia, and they've opened like four. And yeah. I flew back from Vegas like a week ago, and on the way back from the airport, I was like, I'm going to go in this Whataburger. Bro, the line. It was going to take me like an hour and a half. I was like, no thanks, man. I went to the house. I mean, I do love some Whataburger, but.
Yeah. Yeah. The one here, I think, was pretty crazy for a while.
Yeah, dude. I feel like North Carolina is kind of underrated in terms of its musical impact. Like, I think like there's been a lot of incredible like artists come out of there, especially like alt country stuff. Maybe even like punk stuff. Growing up there, I mean, was there like a scene? I mean, I know you were in a small town, but like you're close to some other places. Was there like a scene that you were a part of when you were growing up?
Well, so funnily enough, like even though it was a small town, we had a really, really great little scene for a few years, like in the town. Actually, the guy who's our production manager now, he and I grew up together.
Oh, nice.
And he's a couple years older than me. And he would just be putting on shows wherever he could when I was like just getting into high school, just learning how to play instruments. And so I just remember going to see his bands play. Like, you know, there was like an old high school building that like a dude still owned and kind of ran, and they'd rent the auditorium to you for like, I think it was like $300 a night or something.
Wow.
And so he would rent the auditorium. My dad would like bring speakers to do sound, and we'd just like have a bunch of local bands play. And like, there was this group of guys that age that were all really, really into a very particular kind of math rock.
Yeah.
Like Braid, Mock Orange.
Oh, I love Mock Orange, man. I hadn't heard that name.
Yeah. Yeah. And then like, there's this band actually from Georgia called Cine Mechanica that was never really like particularly well known, but like everybody in our town was really into them for some reason. So they used to come through all the time and play. And so, yeah, I kind of like grew up in that. And then my neighbor was really into like Dave Matthews and Bright Eyes. So nice. I was just like all about the weird chord voicings, trying to learn how to play acoustic guitar stuff. Yeah, it was a really interesting little insulated scene to grow up in. And that's kind of maybe how I would say North Carolina is as a whole, is that like a lot of the music, especially the best stuff, just doesn't ever really leave. Like everybody's kind of just happy to do their own thing, and they'll play local shows, play around the state maybe. But people don't really like tour out of North Carolina that much, like in the grand scheme of things. And so like there's a lot of really great music to listen to and work on and run sound for and share bills with. But outside of the people that were creating it at that time, I don't know how many people ever would have heard of much of it, you know, like
it's crazy though. I feel like I know Ryan Adams and I think Thad Cockrell's from North Carolina, and we have mutual friends in Sarah Shook and the Disarmers, and you know, like, and stuff like
Ben Folds, you know, like
I feel like people just forget. I feel like it's kind of like West Virginia too, or the Virginia Beach, like that impact on hip hop, like Pharrell and Timbaland, and like people don't understand or forget. I forget, like, dude, that whole like Virginia thing was a big deal. And I feel like North Carolina was that for alt country, you know.
That's, yeah, well, and also, you know, in the 90s, even more so, like the whole like Superchunk and like Merge thing, you know, like,
yeah. Yeah, Superchunk was huge, man. There was a whole run of those super bands in the 90s. Superchunk, right. Superdrag, Supergrass. Yeah. There was I don't know why that was, but you say your dad ran sound for all that. Did he play music? Did you grow up around music at the house?
I wouldn't like yes and no. He doesn't play an instrument. He's a great singer. And my mom also doesn't really play much of anything. I think she can probably still noodle around a piano, but they just made me take piano lessons because they also made me play t-ball and basketball. Like, they just wanted me to try everything, you know?
Yeah.
But my dad, instead of going to college, he quit and went on the road with the band Running Sound in the days when you, even as a bar band, you had to bring your own PA, you know?
Yeah.
So he toured around with like a bar band, kind of North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia for a while. And then he started working in radio.
Oh, nice.
And so we just always had like mics and recording software sitting around the house. Cause he ended up teaching radio broadcasting at the community college in town. So in that way, there was a lot of music around the house being played, being listened to. I remember like when he would come like pick my neighbor and I up from school, he would have a couple CDs with him most days of like whatever had been sent into the college radio station.
Oh, I bet that
he
awesome.
Thought we might dig, and we'd listen to it on the way home. There's one day in particular, I remember, he had thrown under the cork tree by Fall Out Boy and this record called Phantoms by the band Acceptance.
Oh yeah.
And we listened to the first few tracks of Under the Cork Tree, Dance, Dance, Sugar, We're Going Down. And thought, we're like, oh, this is cool. Okay. And we popped in the other record, and that Acceptance record is still one of my favorite records of all time.
Really?
It blew my mind immediately. And I was like, oh my God, this band's going to be, you know, so big. And like, fast forward a year, Fall Out Boy is the biggest band in the world, and Acceptance is broken up. You know? It's like, come on, man.
Isn't that how it happens though?
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
There's still like records that I have like this running list of vinyl that I want to collect. You know, I started collecting a lot of it because I wanted my kids to have something. I heard that Bruce Willis tried to put in his living will that he wanted to give his iTunes library to his daughter.
Okay.
And Apple told him no. Like, you can't. What? I don't understand how any of this works. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But it was enough for me to go, you know what? If there's a meaningful album out there, I'm going to go find it on vinyl, and I'm going to, you know, have this collection now, split it among my kids, you know?
Yeah.
And some of the vinyl that I can't find are bands like that. They released a record in the 90s when they weren't printing anything on vinyl.
Right.
And they never pressed it. You know what I'm saying? And so now I'm on like the mad hunt for like the one guy who got a radio promo copy of,
you
know, whatever band that they happen to press. Like, I have a Driving and Crying, Fly Me Courageous vinyl. Then they only did radio ones.
Yeah.
And so it was before vinyl came back, but I think I paid like $75 for it. Now I think it goes for like $400 or $500. It's like something crazy. So I like hardly ever listen to it because I don't want to mess it up. But anyway,
right.
That's how it goes with those bands. You know what I'm saying?
But
if they ever press a vinyl for that Acceptance record, you should get one.
Yeah, I guess. The only records I have are records I've produced that people have sent me because I don't have a record player.
Oh, come on, dude.
So every now and then, when I go home, I'll take some of the records with me and like listen to them on my dad's player.
Yeah.
So they're like, oh, yeah, this one turned out pretty good. Like,
yeah. We tried to get a copy of Bell Bottom Country at the show and they were out. And so I actually just got one at a record shop here and my daughter has commandeered it. I haven't listened to it once because it's in her bedroom. Back and forth between Taylor Swift Midnights in Bell Bottom Country, like all the time, coming from her bedroom. So,
I guess
you're in good company. Yeah,
yeah.
what's like the first stuff you remember hearing around the house, like music wise, that you were like, oh man, that's awesome.
Michael Jackson.
Yeah,
pretty easily. Because the other thing that my dad does on, you know, nights and weekends, if he's not he's basically the only game in town still for
audio.
Doing live sound. Yeah. So anybody that has a little, you know, festival in the park downtown or whatever, you know, he's getting pulled in to do that. But he also like is like a wedding DJ basically. So weddings, corporate events, parties, that kind of stuff. And so I used to go with him to those when I was like a little kid, help him set up, kind of try to like learn what was going on, like how to plug an XLR in, you know, and then that would turn into him using me as bait to try to get like all the old people to dance. So like he'd start playing Michael Jackson and I'd go out on the dance floor and start running around. And then all the, you know, people think it was funny and come over and actually start getting into the music and partying a little bit. But I mean, as far as like mainstream pop music goes, I would say that was pretty easily like a large early influence. Just hearing that at those nights all the time. And I think I like stole the copy of History that he had out of the big like coffin case of CDs that we used to have to carry around.
Yeah.
Two disc changer. And I think I took that and like, I remember, I think he gave me a CD book that he accidentally left his copy of Def Leppard Hysteria in.
Oh, top 10 for me.
Is that the album name?
Yeah, Hysteria. Okay, yeah. Yeah, top 10, dude.
And so me, I was just Michael Jackson to Def Leppard like all the time.
That's, dude, I'll nerd on Def Leppard Hysteria. It is literally in my top 10 records of all time.
It's an incredible album.
The recording, there's been like multiple podcasts about the recording process of that album and how meticulous Mutt Lang was with different parts and everything. And there's an hour and a half, I don't remember who did it, but Phil Collin, the guitarist from Def Leppard, did the podcast, and they were asking him all kinds of like really specific, it was a guitar thing, you know, so they're asking him all the nerd questions, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And man, I'm telling you, the amount of things they did so crazy on that record, and Pour Some Sugar on Me almost didn't make the record. Like, just crazy stories, you know, behind it. But that's Michael Jackson, Def Leppard. That's a solid start right there, dude.
Yeah.
Was that a guitar thing? Like, what was the first record you remember hearing that you were like, I want to play guitar?
Either something Dave Matthews related or AC/DC, probably.
Nice.
I think my dad got me like a live a DVD of AC/DC from, I forget what castle it is or whatever, but I would watch that all the time, which was when I was younger. We had, to go back to Michael for a second, we had the, like, what's it called? Like a Betamax or Beta tape or something. It was like size VHS.
Yeah, bro.
We had a copy of,
you're young for that. You're young for that knowledge, dude.
Yeah. We had a copy of, that Michael Jackson movie that he did, Moonwalker.
Oh my God, that's bull, bro.
Yeah, dude, we had that on like a beta tape, and I would watch it like every day. He like turns into a car at the end, like
so ridiculous.
Yeah. That turned into like, I guess I just like ended up liking watching, you know, music movies, and so I used to watch that AC/DC thing all the time, and then like, I played drums first. And so think I was getting into like, you know, Metallica and AC/DC just for like rock drum stuff, just fun of things to learn to. And then I think that turned into like, once I got introduced to Dave Matthews, I would just play along to the entire Central Park concert, just all 3 hours, just trying to figure out the drum stuff straight through. And then that turned into like, wow, this guitar stuff is really interesting too. And then, you know, at some party, somebody's older boyfriend had a electric guitar and taught me how to play Seven Nation Army, you know, and then I was just like, saved up my lawn mowing money all summer to buy an acoustic and then started learning Dave Matthews songs. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. But awesome. I couldn't really figure out lead for a long time. I had no idea what to do. And so I think trying to learn AC/DC, I got frustrated enough that I actually started taking lessons to like try to delve into the actual theory behind it.
That's awesome. Well, I mean, obviously it worked out.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
Did you like immediately go like, let's put a band together, let's do the garage thing? Or like, what was the next step for you? Did you get into an original band? You get a cover band? Like, what was the next step?
Yeah. The first thing we did was I was playing drums and I'd met a bass player and a guitar player through my guitar teacher because he would do group lessons.
Oh, nice.
So, and then we'd alternate weeks. So like 1 week you'd sit down, all the four of you, learn a song, go over the theory behind it, talk about the rhythm and the lead stuff. You go home and practice that all week. And the next week you come back and he would have his rhythm section from his like bar band come in and play with us. And we would alternate rhythm and lead parts.
That's so cool.
So, yeah, doing like Boston and Avenged Sevenfold and like wild stuff all over the place.
That's great, though.
Yeah, and so it was cool, like actually getting to have the experience of playing with other people while you're trying to learn how to play an instrument.
Yeah.
And through that, one of the bass players and another guitar player that I'd kind of known growing up, we started a band. I think we might have had like one real song, but it was mostly just us trying to like figure out covers. We went and played a Battle of the Bands in like Pinehurst, and played like Master of Puppets, Immigrant Song, like just dumb, you know. We did not win.
Is there a recording of that somewhere?
Actually, there might be. I don't know where it would be at this point, but there was at some point. And then Yeah, like got asked to play guitar in another friend's band in high school, and the singer of that first band and I kind of morphed into doing like an acoustic thing once I started learning how to play guitar.
Yeah.
And so we would just kind of sit around. We were both in theater together, so we just like sit around in theater class and like play acoustic guitar and, you know, like take requests from the girls, you know. And that turned into I convinced my best friend, one of my best friends, to ask his parents for a bass for Christmas, and I taught him how to play it. And so we would sit around a mini disc recorder in our unfinished basement.
Yeah, man, we're pulling out all of the.
There's another pull. Yeah.
all of the dead recording platforms, Betamax, mini discs. Like I said,
like, yeah, my dad was into tech enough that he would always have whatever the newest thing was, even if it was going to be obsolete.
Player, you had an ADAT around there. Yeah.
So we would just sit around a mini disc thing and just record the songs and, like, you know, figure out what was wrong with them and how to get better. And then that turned into, okay, now I've got an electric guitar, and met another drummer and one of the other guitar players from my guitar class played lead, and we had like that was our first proper, like, all original music, like putting on those shows around town and trying to get bigger acts from Raleigh, Greensboro, or some even touring through. Like we could snag people on the way through sometimes, because I remember thinking it was so weird that bands would want to play these shows at like our high school auditorium.
Yeah.
And then like growing up and going on my own tours, I realized like those were like the sickest shows.
Oh yeah.
For a touring band, like coming through, there's like, you know, easily like 500 kids. You're getting paid pretty well. Everybody's buying merch. Like, that's a great night, you know?
Yeah.
Like, or like it's some unknown punk band from Baltimore or whatever, you know?
Yeah, just because it was cool, especially in a smaller town. You know, you really appreciate that stuff. The same thing for me growing up where we did in North Louisiana. Like, anybody comes through, even like somebody's garage, some band's playing, you're like, dude, I'm in. Like, just to see live music was so rare. Back then too, but I know at some point you came across Matt and Kevin, is it the Nolan brothers? At some point you guys knew each other before Laney's band.
Yep.
Were they in that scene too? Did you know them growing up?
No. They're from Laurel, Maryland, and they both ended up going to college at Loyola in New Orleans. And big jazz dudes, and there's a weird Louisiana connection to all of this, because I know they did not meet this guy when they were in Louisiana, but another guy that I know from Louisiana, from Baton Rouge, he and my band were both managed by the same friend for a little while, who was a drummer in like a metal band that we used to tour with. And they kind of stopped touring, and he started doing, you know, like just trying to help people out, like making connections, like that sort of management thing. And then, he convinced Jason to come up from Baton Rouge to my parents' house and record an EP with me, because I was off the road, like producing full time at that point. Nice. And so he was like, you know, he was like, yeah, I'll get a little finder's fee. Basically, like, Jason will pay you. Jason will get a better record than what he has right now, 'cause I, you know, think you're a decent producer or whatever. And so he came up and we did that. And then I think a couple years after that, he moved back to Nashville. He's bounced back and forth between Nashville and Baton Rouge a few times. And by the time I moved to Nashville, he was trying to make another record, and some of the stuff that he had planned kind of fell through. And so he hit me up and was like, hey, so I only have this much money, and like, can you just bring your stuff over to this Airbnb that like my buddy has, and we'll just make a record in a house. And I was like, yeah, sure. And so went over there, and he had met Matt and Kevin sometime in there, I think pretty recently, honestly. And so he had hired them to be the rhythm section on his album. So produced this album in a house. It's like Arctic Monkeys meets Queens of the Stone Age, but from the swamps of Baton Rouge. You know what I mean? Like,
sounds fantastic.
It's a great record. Yeah, it's called Alcatraz by Jason Martin.
Okay.
Yeah. And so it's really riffy, you know, and at that point I was already band leading, MDing, whatever for Laney. And the biggest problem I had with kind of like taken a risk on hiring people is that, you know, a lot of the best players are good enough to just read. And so they'll chart a song once and show up and just read it. And they don't learn sig licks. They don't really know how the song goes. They're not really engaging with the music or the artist. And it bothers me. Like, I get it. Like,
Yeah.
But I just, that wasn't what I wanted for Laney, obviously. And I personally just, like I said, didn't love it. And so them learning these songs for this record, I was like, okay, there's attention to detail there. Like, these guys will learn licks, like, cause it was nonstop riffs. Like, you couldn't fake it. You had to learn.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I just started calling them whenever I needed someone. I just started calling them first, and they were busy and could never really do it. And then Kevin finally played a couple shows with us on bass. And yeah, just over the years, like I said, whenever I could, I'd try to pull them in. And then finally everything timed out, unfortunately, right at the beginning of 2020, where they had some daylight at the beginning of the year, and we had our first real tour opening for Justin Moore and Tracy Lawrence, and they could do most of it. And then actually Jack from Sarah Shook's band.
Yeah.
He and Tommy were my other rhythm section.
Oh, nice.
So I would bounce between the Nolan brothers and the two of them, depending on who could do what weekends. And we got about halfway through that tour doing it that way. And then, you know, the world shut down. So,
man.
Yeah.
How did you get hooked up with Laney in the first place?
I just blind luck.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, I was working with another country artist named Casey Tindall. And she had just moved to Nashville, and Laney's current manager, Mandolin, was living with Casey out in Nashville at the time as well. And so I think they just met her on the songwriting circuit. And I'd been doing production work and like running sound, stuff like that, for this company called Deep South that Mandolin was also working for. And they kind of do like event production management, business management. They do a little bit of everything. They're kind of like the only game in town in Raleigh. And they owned a little bar too. And so like our production manager and I used to work at this bar together. We were like the main sound people. Nice. I'd like run sound for Casey when she came through, and that turned into when they signed Casey to management, they sent her out to our house to do some writing and recording, cause she hadn't really done a lot of that. Our 90s cover band, became her band for like a month. Like we like opened for Charlie Daniels cause she'd never played with a band before, you know?
Oh, wow. Like, yeah.
Yeah. And so, I think they just told me one day that their friend Laney was coming through opening for this guy, Frank Foster, that she used to have a deal with, and just to say hi, you know, whatever. And I was running sound for their show that night. So I just, you know, introduced myself, and she played acoustic with Frank's drummer and bass player, and was just, you know, as energetic as she is now, just kind of like rocking, ripping it up. And that was kind of it for, I don't know, 6 months. I don't think it was like a year later, but it was a while before I was deciding to make the move as well. And then I was out looking for a place to stay, and she was playing around, and Casey and Mandolin were like, hey, you remember our friend Laney? She's playing around at Tin Roof tonight. Do you want to, you know, go and hang out, like meet some people, whatever? I was like, yeah, sure. And so went over there, and she played this song called Dreamcatcher that's on the first project that she and I did together. Yeah. And I was just like, cried in the corner of the bar, like uncontrollably. Nice. And I was like, I was so burned out in general at that point in my life that I was just like, I don't remember the last time that like music made me feel this way.
Yeah.
Like that intense. So I just, after the round, I was just like, hey, you know, I don't know if you remember me or not. We met in Raleigh, but like I'm friends with Casey and Mandolin, and like, you know, I thought the songs you played are great. I think you're a really incredible singer. Like, I'm not really sure what I'm doing, but I am about to move here, and I have historically been a producer. So if you need anything, like, let me know. And I moved in September, and I think in November, maybe she hit me up and we started working on like some acoustic demos.
Yeah.
Just for songs that she liked that she'd written. And basically that batch turned into the EP that she put out, the self-titled that we did together, where like, I think we maybe recorded like 8 tunes that we started working on, just acoustic guitar and vocal. Yeah. And then from that, she picked ones that she liked and was like, hey, can you like produce these up into like full arrangements? And I was basically working out of like a closet in a studio in Goodlettsville, which is like north of Nashville. And it was like an old orthodontist's office or something. And so I was like, basically my mixing room was in one of the exam rooms, you know, windowless, Yeah. And so I like all the drums on that stuff's programmed, you know, and it was just me. It was me spending a lot of time trying to see how good I could make fake stuff sound. Cause I was like, if I can, this is my first opportunity to record country songs like this, you know?
Yeah.
So if I can come up with a process now, that I can use as a template, maybe I can streamline, and maybe this is the work that I do moving forward. I'll just try to make friends with a bunch of songwriters and just do demos for them.
Yeah, totally.
Because I'd heard a lot of other demos for other tunes that like Casey or whoever had written, and I was just like, these are bad. And I feel like you can get a better demo really quickly.
Well, it's crazy too. I mean, there's guys who make a living just cutting demos all day.
Yeah.
Like a good living, like players. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, producers obviously too, but.
Yeah, that was the thing is like, I could make more for a demo recording for a songwriter in Nashville than I could make for a master from a band in North Carolina.
Oh yeah.
You know? So it just, seemed like a no brainer, and it was fun. So I wasted way too much time on that first batch of songs. Just like, I think there's probably like 4 or 5 versions of Working Overtime, and most of them are terrible. And then I finally like came up with this slide lick that I thought worked. And then that, you know, that was the beginning of like, oh, okay, maybe this is like a sound. Like, okay, this is how you play country music.
Was that new to you? I mean, it seems like you grew up playing hardcore music mostly, or heavy stuff.
Yeah.
I know the Dave Matthews thing and the Bright Eyes thing and all that sort of stuff, but like, it seemed like that's what you were saying scene-wise, you guys were kind of around more.
Yeah. Like, my high school band was definitely very, like, on the poppier side of the like math rock thing, like we were more Hey Mercedes than Braid, if you will, you know, like, okay. But yeah, like most of my time spent touring was with heavier bands, but our band was like Jimmy Eat World, brand new, kind of like nothing that heavy.
Yeah.
We get into some Deftones, but that was that kind of heavy if we got heavy, you know,
just
big and slow and, you know,
thoughtfully heavy.
Yeah. Yeah, but I filled in for the metal band that we used to tour with on guitar on a couple of shows because one of their guys couldn't make it up from Baton Rouge.
Everyone is connected to Louisiana.
Yeah, somehow, man. It's everybody. So funny. Yeah. But yeah, country was a whole new thing, and funnily enough, like, I think right around the time I moved and all of this was happening, I think Brothers Osborne had Stay a Little Longer and Ain't My Fault out. And so I'd heard those on like a Spotify playlist at the radio or something when I was trying to go through and look for stuff I dug for to use as a reference or whatever, you know? And so they were like the first country band that I was like, whoa, like these dudes rip. Like,
yeah,
I love this.
Yeah, their records sound great too.
Yeah. I was like, I want to emulate this. I want to, you know, like, let's use this for some inspiration. And so, that the version of that Working Overtime tune that ended up working, was basically me ripping off Pawn Shop, which is another song on that album. Hilariously enough, I did not know who produced the record. I didn't look into it at all. But then fast forward like 5 years and Lainey is recording with Jay Joyce, who produced that Brothers Osborne record. Nice. Lainey's first song that we did together was a completely unintentional rip of the guy who we would end up.
Have you told him that?
No, I haven't told Jay that yet. Yeah.
You should tell him.
Yeah. I don't think it's come up in a easy way.
That's awesome. That's awesome, dude.
Pretty funny.
Well, it seems like y'all been killing it. I mean, I brought my family. I was telling you before we hit red on this. You were so gracious, invited us out to the Roxy show, and my daughter and I got to hang with you guys. And I think that Lainey's band's pretty eclectic. Like, all the people around her are very different. But I think what draws people to her camp is the fact that she's just so herself. And even if, like, modern country may not be somebody's cup of tea, she's an artist that I just go, man, that record's awesome. It's going to end up in my top like 5 probably in my Apple Music replay, like stuff I listen to the most this year, you know, kind of thing. Just, you know, I was telling you, like, that was my son's first show. He's 15. That'll for the rest of his life be the first concert he ever went to. Lainey Wilson at the Roxy.
That's so crazy.
Yeah. And my daughter had a blast, brought a friend with her. She had a blast. My wife had a blast. I had a blast. It was just great. And then getting to spend some time with Lainey just was, you know, icing on the cake. Just, it was such a great environment. And it's no surprise to me that people connect with the authenticity of it all.
Yeah.
And so as much as the songs are great, the record's great top to bottom, just, I think people connect with that. And I think it's bringing new fans into country music and, all that sort of, like, my daughter, Harley, if ever, never listened to country music. And now it's like blaring out of her bedroom. It's always Bell Bottom Country, but, you know, yeah. Bell Bottom Country is going to be her gateway drug to like Merle Haggard.
Right. You know? Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think there was, I would like to think that I felt pretty good about what we were doing already, but
yeah.
Also once I started like showing friends like, hey, you know, this is like what I'm doing now. I'm like working on this country stuff. And they're all like, this is really cool. Like
yeah.
All the punk dudes that I used to tour with, like everybody was just like, this rips. Like,
yeah.
And so I think that was pretty affirming and has continued to happen. We're like, recently I've been kind of putting it like, I think she's a crossover artist, not in the way that she's going to try to cross over into pop like other artists have done,
sure.
But in the sense of like, she's crossing fans over into country. She's like,
which is
I really have had that experience.
Me.
Yeah.
I mean, in a lot of regards, you know, I heard you say something you said made me think of this. I heard you say you posted or something, maybe it was on social or maybe it was when we were talking. I can't remember, but you were like, oh, this is my favorite solo to play every night. What is your favorite solo to play every night? You said this before, and I can't remember what song it. I can't remember what song it was. Grease.
I mean, yeah, Grease is really fun. It's so yeah, Grease. I was thinking about Grease a minute ago, actually. Like, that's probably like one of the most difficult but simple songs to play because I'm just bouncing back and forth between sounds and parts so fast.
Yeah,
and it's like cool and funky as most of it is, and then like the bridge section that the solo goes over, I think Jay referred to as like he wanted like an English beat kind of like,
yeah,
weird like British reggae kind of thing.
Yeah,
but then the chords that Rob McNally ended up playing are like the same kind of like weird seventh chunky octave mix chords that like we would do in like math rock stuff back in the day.
Yeah.
So like that's a really weird full circle song that like it has those elements. It's got the funk that like the other dudes in the band really dig into. It's got this weird math rock section. And then the guitar solo is just like this straight up clean DI Telly country solo that Charlie Worsham played.
Oh.
And so I tried to learn that as close as I could because I just thought it was so cool. But yeah, it's a fun, challenging tune to do.
Yeah, it's dude. So the was it the AMCs recently when you guys did that?
ACMs. Yeah,
ACMs. Yeah, ACM. That performance was awesome.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Yeah, I'll link that in the show notes because people need to see that. But that song to me, there's something about it because I noticed a couple, I don't know, like a month or so ago, Lainey posted something. You guys were in Nashville and this like. I don't know, group of like break dancers or something like,
yeah,
did something to it. And then that became part of like the video. And I guess that's a new single because there's been a lot of promo. I don't even know how singles releasing work because nobody listens to the radio. So I don't understand how that works, but I think it's a single because there's a music video that just came out for it.
Right.
And all those, is that the same guys in the video?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Those guys came and, shot that video, that morning, and then they came to Brooklyn Bowl. It was our second Brooklyn Bowl show that night, and they did the dance on stage with her as well. Yeah, like I think they actually were at a show in North Carolina that we played.
Huh.
I think she just like randomly found them breakdancing somewhere like after the show and just like stayed in touch. Yeah. But yeah, so like I think technically for like, because country is still a mostly radio driven genre when it comes to that kind of stuff, I would say it's not a single because we're not going to radio with it.
Okay.
But, yeah, like for both the last album and this, album. I think there's been songs that we as a group have wanted to push regardless of whether we thought it would work at radio or not. Mm-hmm. And so like LA, funnily enough, it's like the funk stuff, like LA from the first record.
Oh man, my daughter loves that song. That's a great song.
Yeah. Like probably wasn't going to work at country radio, but like, I think Bobby Bones played it some on, and then maybe like it got played on Sirius or something. And so we were like kind of trying to push that digitally for a while.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what's going on with Grease, where it's like, it's one of our favorite songs to perform and play and listen to. Like, we've been excited about it since the demo. And her creative director, Cece Dawson, also really loves it. And so she had, I guess, just pitched this idea for the video like a while ago. And yeah, nobody really bit. And then I think she finally was like, I'm just going to make it. You guys do whatever you want with it, but I'm making a video, you know.
Well, it turned out dope. I saw it last week whenever it dropped. I watched the whole thing because I was interested to see if those dancers were in it. And the only reason now that we're talking about Grease, it kind of breaks a lot of cultural sort of lines. Like, I don't know, like a country song with, and it's not in a cheesy, like forced, like, I don't know, man, there's something about what's going on around what Lainey's doing, what you guys are all doing together, that's just super different to me. And it's intriguing and encouraging and exciting and lots of cool stuff happening around that.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, like you said earlier, makes it a lot easier when she's just being herself. Like, you don't have to, you're not trying to do anything. It's just, that's what happens.
Yeah, know? Dude. I mean, I'm from North Louisiana too. I can tell if somebody's being from North Louisiana or not.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? My favorite track on the record is Hold My Halo. Is that a single? Technically, was that a single?
No.
Okay.
Didn't get a radio with that either. I think it was discussed, but
That's a great single. That would be awesome. Yeah.
No, it was definitely in the running, but I think they're going with something else.
She pushed it a lot on social, and that was the song. Like, when I got into it, it was like before Bell Bottom Country came out. My dad actually knows somebody in her family. It's North Louisiana. You got to be careful who you date. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And was like, hey, you ever heard of this girl? And anyway, I started listening to some of the last record, and then they started promo for the new record, and she kept posting little clips of Hold My Halo. I was like, man, that's a catchy chorus. Yeah. 'Cause that's all that she posted for like a month and a half. I'm like, when's this song? I want to hear this song.
Yeah.
That solo is super fun too. I actually sat down, I'll make a list of tunes that I go, I just want to learn that, just to learn, you know, just to learn something. Yeah. That's how I feel like I get better as a guitar player, is just learning songs, you know, and then figuring out how they apply. And so I learned that whole tune, the solo and everything. It's super fun song. So
yeah,
I know you guys got a busy year ahead of you, and you're only home today.
And behind us. Yeah.
Yeah. Before you leave again. So I appreciate the time, dude. I always ask, like, you got three records, Desert Island albums for Aslan Freeman. Do you know your three Desert Island records?
I had a pretty good five going at one point. Mm. Three is tough. I mean, in spite of the fact that I haven't listened to it in a while because of personal reasons, Dark Twisted Fantasy by Kanye is like way up there for me still.
Yeah, still a great record, man.
Yeah, another one that I also haven't listened to because of, you know, people's personal problems, as Devil and God Raging Inside Me by Brand New. But I mean, it's like, those are two perfect records. Like, there's just no two ways around it. Number three, I'll mix it up a little bit.
Right. And you can have four if you want it. I'll give you four if you want it.
No, I'll take the three. I can think of like, there's definitely some options, you know, if you're going for like what was more influential and whatever.
Yeah.
We were just talking about this one the other day, so it's on my mind. A record called Death Magic by a band called Health.
Okay.
That record is incredible. If I had to sneak a fourth in, it would be that Acceptance record probably, but.
All right. I'll let that one slide because we already talked about it. Yeah. I'm gonna go check out that Health record. I always love finding. It's so funny. Like, very rarely does anyone's Desert Island. You know, I've had, you know, over 30 episodes of this podcast in the last year, and very rarely does anybody's Desert Island records cross over. I think Appetite for Destruction's maybe been mentioned twice.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? But it's pretty common. So. Yeah. But it's been great, man. I really appreciate the time, dude. This has been an awesome conversation. I know you guys are so busy. I hope you guys have safe travels and just a super great year, and just stay on the trajectory you're on, man. So appreciate the time, man. Thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, of course. I will leave you with this. If you haven't, I'd also say this probably way, I like harp on this way more than I probably should, but if you have never learned the guitar solo, the extended full guitar solo to My Sharona, you need to go learn that.
Done.
There's a 5 minute version of My Sharona that's not the radio edit that has one of the most amazing guitar solos of all time on it.
That fantastic, dude. I'm on it. I needed something. I was sitting here today going, what am I going to learn next? Extended My Sharona. I'll shoot something and I'll send it to you just for accountability's sake. You know what I'm saying? That I had to learn it. So anyway, I appreciate it, bro. Thanks for being on.
Yeah. Thanks, man.
Man, what a great conversation. Aslan's an awesome dude, playing for a great artist in Lainey Wilson. He's got a lot going on we didn't get to talk about. We didn't talk about their fall tour. We didn't talk about all the records he's worked on. But the good news is you can follow him on social media. Make sure you do that at FutureGhost41 on Instagram. You can also follow at Lainey Wilson Music to keep up with everything they got going on there. LaineyWilson.com, and you can also check out AslanFreeman.com, and he's got some stuff there, some productions that he's worked on, things like that, how to get in touch with him, you know, all that sort of stuff. So, but follow Aslan on social, at FutureGhost41 on Instagram, and make sure you're following at Lainey Wilson Music as well, so you know what's going on with all them. And also make sure you're following MyFi at MyFi Podcast everywhere, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, the whole deal. Also check out myfipodcast.com. You can go back and listen to old episodes, get connected with the info, sign up for the newsletter, all this sort of stuff to make sure you stay connected to the podcast. Make sure and share it with somebody. Tell somebody about MyFi. We got some great guests on coming up, and super excited about those episodes. So stay tuned. So glad that you're checking in. Make sure to just enjoy yourself. Enjoy music. It's summertime. You know what I'm saying? If you're listening to this anytime near where it came out, it's summertime. So enjoy yourself. Enjoy music. Share some good music with some friends. And until next time, you guys all have a good one.